Today is Tuesday, July 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a civil rights pioneer is being remembered as the conscience of the U.S. Congress.
God truly blessed America with the life and leadership of John Lewis.
Police and protesters clash again as demonstrations grow in several American cities. Also ahead, new research could be a game changer in finding a vaccine for malaria.
Just early days now, but we're really excited about how this has given us a key insight to why we keep having this problem with our vaccines for malaria.
It's all on today's International Edition. The World Health Organization warns COVID-19 is continuing to accelerate globally at breathtaking speed. But as Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, the WHO says basic public health measures, if followed, can control its spread and turn the pandemic around.
The number of coronavirus cases globally has roughly doubled in the past 6 weeks. More than 16 million cases of the virus have been reported to the World Health Organization, including more than 640,000 deaths. The Americas is the most seriously affected region, with the United States topping the number of infections at more than 4 million cases and over 143,000 deaths. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says many lessons have been learned since the pandemic was declared a public health emergency of international concern on January 30th. The most important, he says, is that those countries that have applied basic health measures are containing the virus. He says finding, isolating, testing, and tracing contacts, as well as social distancing and wearing masks, can suppress transmission and save lives.
Where these measures are followed, cases go down. Where they are not, cases go up. Countries and communities that have followed this advice carefully and consistently have done well.
Tedros says countries such as Cambodia, New Zealand, Rwanda, and Thailand have succeeded in preventing large-scale outbreaks by following this advice. He says other countries, including Canada, China, and Germany, have brought large outbreaks under control by applying these basic measures. Executive Director of WHO Health Emergencies Mike Ryan says countries that have implemented control measures have suppressed the virus. But when those measures are lifted, the virus returns.
What is clear that pressure on the virus successfully pushes the numbers down, release pressure on the virus, and the numbers can creep back up. Every single country where pressure has been lifted on the virus, where virus is still at community level, there's been a jump back in cases.
WHO officials agree that continuing transmission of COVID-19 and its resurgence in countries where it had been controlled is worrying. However, they say countries can turn the pandemic around by maintaining pressure on the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. deaths from COVID-19 rose for a third week in a row to more than 6,300 people in the 7 days ending on Sunday. The number of new cases, though, fell 2%, dropping for the first time after rising for 5 straight weeks. 15 states have reported weekly increases in deaths for at least 2 consecutive weeks. Well, as the world races to develop a vaccine for COVID-19, researchers from the Australian National University say they've discovered a vital clue as to why malaria vaccines keep failing, and that discovery could potentially change how vaccines for this and other deadly diseases are made. Joining us now to hear more is Haley McNamara, PhD scholar and lead author of the research at the university's John Curtin School of Medical Research.
Malaria has been around for a long time, and it's deadly and it's frightening because obviously it's so easy to get something like this with a little tiny mosquito in so many places that have so little access. And, you know, as we're looking here for the miracle vaccine for COVID, there are things that are out there that are deadly as well that we've been looking for years that we haven't been able to capture. And that would include malaria. But it sounds like your research has uncovered some significant findings. What exactly is this all about?
You're right. We've been looking to generate an effective malaria vaccine for decades. And the approach to this has been largely the same as as for many other vaccines, where we identify a key target on the infectious agent, in our case, the malaria parasite, and then we work to make a vaccine that induces your body to make a lot of protective proteins called antibodies. Now, this approach is generally good for a lot of vaccines and against many diseases, but in malaria, we found that even though we can develop vaccines that do cause your body to make antibodies against the malaria parasite, they're unable to provide prolonged protection. And we really wanted to address why this was the case. Why can't we have adequate protection against getting infected, even though we have protective antibodies present, which are induced by our current vaccines?
So what was the outcome? What did you discover?
So what's quite interesting about malaria is that you need a really high amount of antibodies present to provide complete protection. So this may be because it's a complex pathogen. So at different stages of the malaria infection, it expresses different proteins. So it's really important if you want to catch and prevent the disease from progressing that you basically knock it out in one stage, which your immune system is primed to target. Because there's such a high requirement, or you need a lot of antibodies present, what we found is that this amount of antibody is actually unsustainable to be continually maintained within your body. Your body naturally maintains the antibody level at a much lower level. And what we found is this discrepancy between what we need for protection and what is actually normally maintained in the body is part of this negative feedback mechanism, which is basically your body's way of preventing it from needlessly making more antibody when it doesn't need to. And in most cases, in most diseases, this doesn't seem to be an issue. That's why we have vaccines for lots of other infections that don't seem to have this problem occurring. But because we need such high titers for malaria, this poses a problem. And what our research shows is that one way to overcome this may be designing vaccines that work on generating antibodies against multiple targets on the parasite rather than just one particular protein. And this is largely because when we talk about antibodies, they're highly specific. So if you have one antibody against protein A on the parasite, that means it will only bind to protein A, even if there's protein A, B, C, D on the parasite. So what we're saying is instead of having enormous amounts of antibodies against just protein A, which we can't sustain at such high levels, maybe have a reduced amount of antibodies against protein A, B, and D, and then together they can work synergistically to provide protection.
Fascinating. So where does it go from here as far as the work to actually find a vaccine to prevent malaria?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Obviously, this is showing that our current strategy of developing a vaccine is not going to work in this particular situation. It's starting to be realized as well, because people in the past have tried to really push getting the antibodies up to that high protective level by administering more booster vaccines, and that doesn't work because of this feedback mechanism. So I don't think we need to go right back to the drawing board. I think what we can do is we can build on some basic research, which has been looking at identifying other proteins on the parasite that may be targets. And if we can somehow incorporate them to our current vaccine strategies, that might be a way forward. Again, how to improve the current strategies. Potentially, we may need to start considering doing like a sequential vaccine. So rather than one vaccine, which is the same, and then maybe a booster, which is identical in structure, maybe we vaccinate sequentially where you have like your first vaccine is against one particular protein, your second is against a different protein on the parasite. So it's a sequential vaccination regime that could potentially be another way to work around this. But again, this is just early days now, but we're really excited about how this has given us a key insight to why we keep having this problem with our vaccines for malaria.
Do you think this ultimately, this could be the game changer that scientists have been looking for with malaria and potentially other diseases that have eluded being able to find vaccines for, like HIV/AIDS?
I think it's definitely going to highlight consideration that we have to have with vaccine design, especially for these complex diseases that we have been having difficulty to generate effective vaccines for. Yes, absolutely. This particular phenomenon in immunology, it's actually been known, this whole antibody feedback, for ages, but people actually haven't looked at it in terms of vaccine responses and the immune response to vaccines. And I think what we're showing is that when we have these diseases where we know you need a lot of antibody present to provide protection, this now has to be considered. And when you start to design what these vaccines are looking like, maybe you have to start really thinking about if this could be a potential problem down the line.
Haley McNamara, PhD scholar and lead author on research on malaria vaccines at the Australian National University's John Curtin School of Medical Research. International students at U.S. colleges and universities are now technically free to return, but a number of hurdles and concerns are keeping them from home. Additionally, as students of color, they worry about the non-viral threats of life in a racially charged nation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg on how two South African students are dealing with the deferral of their college dreams.
And part of texture.
Tarika Pather never thought she would be stuck at home right now in Johannesburg. Instead, the 20-year-old aspiring architect hoped to begin studies as a freshman at Smith College in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. But in the months since being admitted, the coronavirus shut down global travel. Also, the U.S. government initially said in June it would revoke visas for international students who do not attend in-person classes, but then reversed course. Still, routine visa appointments at U.S. consulates in South Africa are suspended.
I am waiting to see if there's a possibility of getting a visa, because if I can get a visa for fall, they basically, Smith is allowing some students to live on campus in very like strict conditions. But if I don't get a visa for fall, like if all the administrative like processes block me, hopefully I'll be going in spring semester of 2021, which would be February.
Across town, college sophomore Kaya Kingston is also at home, a world away from Harvey Mudd College in California. His college sent all students home after spring break, curtailing his first year. Although Johannesburg's airport is still operating, it's difficult to get a flight out. And as a young black man, he and his parents also worry about the wave of protests over police brutality against people of color.
They trust that I'll be responsible, be as responsible as I can in this situation, and do what I can to prevent anything like that. They're more worried about me getting sick. And I have, I think, one family member in America. So if I do get sick and I can't come back, or someone gets sick here and I can't come back, they don't like the idea of me being on the other side of the world. But I think that they're okay with the idea of me leaving now.
The protests also concern Patha.
As a brown person who looks Indian, like I don't feel comfortable at all, especially because even within the northern states, for example, in Philadelphia, when there were Black Lives Matter protests, I read and my friend told me that there were actually neo-Nazi protesters within the crowd who would just like start beating up people and start trouble. So I'm feeling like a lot more afraid and a lot more uncomfortable at the thought of going to the U.S. than I would have like a while ago.
While the youth are less worried about the viral threat, it weighs on their parents' minds.
You know, the pandemic brings all sorts of other concerns. We are really concerned at how the United States is not dealing with the virus and, you know, what that means for students when they do eventually get there physically.
In the meantime, these students are trying to keep busy. Pather interns at an architectural firm, and Kingston, a physics and computer science major, volunteers on a data science team tracking the virus's growth in South Africa. It is worlds away from lecture halls and ivy-covered buildings, but they say it is an education of a different sort. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The body of late Congressman John Lewis is at the U.S. Capitol, where he will lie in state as lawmakers pay tribute to the longtime Georgia congressman and civil rights icon. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports on the memorial for the man colleagues refer to as the conscience of Congress.
Here in Congress, John was revered and beloved on both sides of the aisle, on both sides of the Capitol. We knew that he always worked on the side of the angels, and now we know that he is with them.
Ready, step!
A military honor guard carrying Lewis' casket up the steps of the Capitol. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Lewis leaves a legacy.
John firmly focused on the future, on how to inspire the next generation to join the fight for justice. And his quote, to find a way to get in the way.
A reporter asked President Trump if he will go to the Capitol.
No, I won't be going. No.
Trump was leaving the White House for a trip to North Carolina at the same time that Lewis' body was arriving at the Capitol.
Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden and wife Dr. Jill Biden paid their respects to Lewis at the U.S. Capitol, as did Vice President Mike Pence and wife Karen. As America remembers John Lewis for his lifelong nonviolent fight for racial equality, demonstrations turned violent over the weekend in several cities as protests against racial injustice began months ago show no signs of letting up. Demonstrators took to the streets of Portland, Oregon for a 60th straight night. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
In Portland, Oregon, another night of tear gas set off by federal agents outside the courthouse as protesters chanted for them to leave the city. Police say arrests were made, a gun was recovered, and someone ended up in the hospital with an unexplained gunshot. In Seattle, police were forced to retreat into a station house. In California and Richmond, Virginia, vehicles were set on fire, and in Austin, Texas, an armed protester was shot and killed after police say he approached a car that had driven through a demonstration and that driver shot him. And authorities in Aurora, Colorado say someone was shot and wounded after a car drove through a protest there. I'm Julie Walker.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. China took over the premises of the U.S. consulate in the southwestern city of Chengdu Monday after ordering the facility vacated in retaliation for China's ouster last week from its consulate in Houston, Texas. The dramatic escalation in tensions between the world powers began when employees in China's Houston consulate were seen burning documents last Tuesday, just hours before Beijing announced it had been told to leave the facility. Satellite images show Iran has moved a mock-up U.S. aircraft carrier to the strategic Strait of Hormuz, suggesting it will use the look-alike vessel for target practice in war games in a Gulf shipping channel vital to world oil exports. The use of dummy American warships has become an occasional part of Iran's Revolutionary Guards and Naval Forces training. And 95 migrants found in distress on a dinghy north of Libya were rescued and brought ashore by Malta's armed forces on Monday. A volunteer organization, Alarm Phone, on Sunday morning said the boat was overcrowded and taking in water when spotted within Malta's search and rescue region. Greek businesses have launched a trade boycott against Turkey, ratcheting up pressure on the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan to rescind its decision to revert a 1,500-year-old historic monument into a mosque. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Vasilis Korkidis, a leading representative of commerce in Greece, is blunt about the need, as he puts it, to strike back at Turkey. We recognize the ongoing works and efforts of the government to counter the recasting of Hagia Sophia, he says. However, until that materializes into something concrete, Korkidis says, Greek businesses should waste no time in boycotting trade with their Turkish partners. Even on a personal level, he says, consumers should follow suit. They can do so immediately, he says, boycotting Turkish goods, which bear the numbers 868 and 869 on the barcodes of imported products. Despite age-old animosity between the two countries, trade relations have grown substantially in recent years. Greece's annual exports to Turkey total about $1.6 billion, significantly more than the $1.2 billion in imports from Turkey. Whether Greeks will heed the trade boycott remains unclear, especially as the economy here has been thrown into chaos by the COVID-19 pandemic. However, the anger, the sadness, and the resentment toward the Hagia Sophia recast weighs heavily in this largely Eastern Orthodox country, so much, in fact, that experts say any short-lived trade gain is offset by bigger losses. Korkidis explains. We may enjoy a generous trade surplus, he says, but when you factor in the resources that Greece has to pull together to fend off continued flows of illegal migration from Turkey and the huge military costs now racking up to safeguard against Turkish provocations, well, all of that wipes out any semblance of a surplus. The issue of Hagia Sophia is just the latest of a string of crises Greece is facing from its fellow NATO member Turkey. Relations have been aggravated for years over land and sea rights in the Aegean, as well as thousands of illegal migrants continuing to stream into Greece from Turkey. In recent weeks also, tensions have soared as Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan vowed to begin drilling for oil and gas in waters Greece considers its own. Greek business associations say they are already reaching out to partner organizations across Europe to build an even broader boycott against Turkey. It is clear that the West is becoming increasingly unnerved by the actions of Turkey, Gorgidis says. It is high time, he says, that Erdogan's government stops using cultural issues to advance its political agenda. The trade boycott is just one of many grassroots movements and protests swelling in Greece. On Sunday alone, church bells tolled anew across the nation, while tens of thousands of people packed into houses of prayer, singing hymns in honor of the Hagia Sophia, the seat of Eastern Christianity for about 1,000 years before Ottoman Turks conquered its host city, then known as Constantinople. In more worrying signs, though, teams of far-right nationalists fanned out across a city in northern Greece torching a Turkish flag. The Greek government condemned the move. Still, it stoked nationalist and patriotic passions with a fresh round of stinging remarks against the country's age-old foe by Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. Meταραχοποιούς, όπως η Τουρκία, να απειλούν την ειρήνη σε Ανατολική Μεσόγειο. Turkey is a troublemaker threatening peace and security in the region, he says. But we have shown that we can defend our borders, the European Union's frontiers. Greece believes the Hagia Sophia conversion is part of a bigger plan by Turkey to reassert itself as a regional and energy superpower. Turkey says Greece is significantly overreacting. Even so, Greece insists it is not taking any chances, keeping its forces on code red alert, ready to wage war if further provoked on any front. Anthika Rasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
City center shops and malls may have lost their appeal during the COVID-19 pandemic, but as lockdowns ease across Europe, many stores in and around residential areas stand to benefit as consumers remain reluctant to venture far from home. Kiara Lee reports.
City centres have struggled under lockdown. That's leaving Europe's most renowned shopping districts struggling in the absence of office workers and tourists. On Germany's main shopping streets, footfall in June was down by about half compared with a year earlier. In London's West End, it was down around 75%. But there are some retailers not feeling quite the same pain. As restrictions ease across Europe, many stores in and around residential areas are benefiting. That's because many consumers are still reluctant to venture far from home and are buying local instead. While retail sales appear to be rebounding, surging 17.8% in the Eurozone in May and approaching pre-lockdown levels in Britain in June, shoppers are increasingly staying closer to home. Data from Ernst & Young shows that 46% of consumers across Europe aim to shop more locally in the long term. The trend could mean a significant shift in earnings patterns for major European retail landlords. Germany's ECE operates nearly 200 shopping centres across Europe. It told Reuters that centres in areas with a local customer base are approaching pre-lockdown footfall levels. But city centre locations are serving just two-thirds of their usual customer base. In Britain, shoppers are buying local not just for convenience goods, but other items too, such as clothes. Half of Britons in a survey said they'd feel uncomfortable visiting an enclosed retail space like a shopping mall. That's already prompted big retailers to retrench. Marks and Spencer and John Lewis, among others, have announced store closures and hefty layoffs.
Reuters' Kara Lee reporting. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Experts agree that until there's an effective vaccine against the coronavirus, the best countermeasures remain social distancing, masks, and frequent hand washing. Early detection can help control the spread. And as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, German troops are already training their four-legged counterparts.
Recently at this academy in Ulm, Germany, army trainers tested a new weapon in the fight against the coronavirus. German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer says this dog training program is a first of its kind.
The school is unique for the military, but even in an international context, it is a special asset that we can offer. Here it is not just people being trained at school, but dogs and people training side by side.
The dogs can't sniff out the actual virus, but they can detect the biochemical changes it causes in saliva. These dogs produce results with samples as small as 100 microliters.
To put it simply, we're investigating whether service dogs can be used to detect COVID-19. Not because they can smell the virus itself, but they can smell the biochemical processes and the changes caused by the virus.
Kramp-Karrenbauer says while tests are encouraging, studies remain ongoing.
I want to make clear here the next steps, like, for example, differentiating between coronavirus and influenza, or to differentiate an active carrier, are all questions to be answered. And so we'll need more months to be able to offer up clear results.
Military dog trainers and the Hanover University of Veterinary Medicine are currently working with a variety of breeds on a rewards-based system where dogs get treats for properly identifying tainted saliva. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Got a black magic woman. Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac guitarist and co-founder of the influential rock group, died in his sleep over the weekend. Green also made his mark as a composer with Albatross and as a songwriter with Black Magic Woman. In 1998, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other past and present members of Fleetwood Mac. Peter Green was 73. Don't turn your back on me, baby. Yes, you've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Take care, be well, have a great day.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists, win prizes, and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London. Twitter at Border Crossings or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.